Welcome to the Tailoring Talk Show with me, your host, Roberto Revilla. I'm a bespoke tailor, menswear designer, and owner of Roberto Revilla London Suit and Shirt Makers. This is the podcast where you drop in for the threads, but often leave with something quite unexpected. If you haven't already, please support the show by subscribing. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, please help me out by leaving a rating and a review. It's time for part four of the massive Tailoring Talk James Bondathon, where we follow the James Bond series in order, ticking off each movie as each month goes by. My guest and I will be deep diving into each film, covering everything from our overall review, and then digging into the clothes, the gadgets, the cast, our favourite moments from each instalment, and much, much more. So, being part four, this means we go back in time to 1965. Yes, it's Thunderball. I'm joined once again by our resident poker star. If MI6 had put him up against Le Chiffre in Casino Royale, it would have been a much shorter film. It's Philip Rahman. Philip, how are you?
I'm good, Bobby. How are you?
Good, thank you. And yet again, Phil, we're not alone. Yes, it's my fabulous colleagues and dear friends from the Play, Pause, Turn podcast. Starting with the PPT voice of reason. If we were the Ghostbusters, he would be our Ray Stans. It's the lovely Alex Hansford. Alex, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Hi, guys.
So, Alex, you're really excited this week because we're going to see Doctor Strange later in the week, and it's all your fault because you're the one that was corralling everybody and, you know, harassing me to get it all booked.
Quite right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Exactly. Anyway, we're going off piece. Wrong franchise. Let's get back to Dan, Jack, or whatever they're called, and Bond. And who else have we got? Oh, yes. How could I forget? And not just Play Paul's Turn podcast intrepid leader, he's the coolest dark saber wielding IT teacher around, and also known as The Voice. It's John Evans. John, how are you?
It's a reluctant title, I have to say. I can't hear my own voice. This is the problem. To me, I don't sound sexy. That's the issue.
And we all think you're pretty. now we're going to do a little spoiler warning, because even though Thunderball has been out for a very short time, 57 odd years to be exact, if you haven't seen it yet, this is the official Tailoring Talk spoiler warning, because we are going to be spoiling the living daylights out of this movie.
Very good.
Too soon. So we're going to start with some opening questions to get our guests warmed up. I will confess that I forgot to actually send these questions out to my guests. So they're completely unprepared. So this is totally cold, but they're extremely talented and very quick off the mark. So I'm sure they're going to do really well. So I begin with a threat of torture to our guests with either a smouldering cigar or ice cubes, as did Largo when he threatened Domino. So, Phil, would you like ice cubes or a painful burn?
I think I'd go for a painful burn.
Okay. Philip, if you were the head of an evil international organization and one of your number twos through to number 12s did something you did not approve of, how would you deal with them?
I think I would torture them horribly and then kill them painfully.
Would you use the sword from the last episode?
Yes, I would. In between their legs.
Okay,
it's gone
very
dark very suddenly, isn't it?
Yeah,
well, if you haven't heard the Goldfinger one with Alex, Phil and I, that did take a very dark turn. On to Alex. Alex, ice cubes or a poke in the thigh with a hot Monte Cristo?
I would have ice cubes, but I would probably shriek like a girl.
So, Alex, your question. If you were the head of an evil international organization and one of your number twos through to number 12s did something you did not approve of, how would you deal with them?
I'd drop them into a tank with sharks with laser beams on their head.
What, laser beams on?
Laser beams on the heads
employees'
of the shark.
Head.
No.
Oh, on the heads of the sharks.
Yeah, best way to go.
Okay.
Just proper yeah. Austin Powers style.
I mean, that would just be total carnage. I mean, it would be human and fish sushi all mixed up.
But then really importantly, you would see lots of pictures of the shark swishing and laser beams, and then we would retract the cover so that you never actually saw anything, because you know it's only really a PG, isn't it, Bond?
So yeah.
You wouldn't see all the blood and guts.
The retractable cover would be definitely the way to get the rating down if you needed to yeah. pass censorship. Yeah,
that's right.
Never mind and the mess.
And then they'd shoot the water red.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. But it would be, the nice thing is if you had the cover, it would be like wiped clean. So that's very practical. Yeah. So, you know, I think this is good. This is good. We're learning good stuff here.
So, John, again, if you've not heard the Goldfinger episode yet, Innocent Alex has been, what's the word? We've broken Alex, basically. We basically got talking about, I can't remember, what the hell were we talking about? It was our sort of favoured weapons. Oh, that was it. We were talking about gold-encrusted pistols and stuff, and then we were like, if we were evil gangsters or whatever, what would our weapon of choice be? And anyway, I won't spoil it for you. If you haven't heard it yet, you'll hear the point where Alex ceased to become the Alex that we know and love. Anyway, moving on, because John's obviously itching to get his one off. Finally, John, should I tease you slowly with the ice cubes, or would you like me to burn your nuts off with my Koiba?
I think I'd go for the ice cubes, because when you finished, I would just casually drop them into a nice glass of Macallan 25 and finish them off with a nice whiskey, basically, if you let
that
me.
That sounds
obviously.
Lovely. Yeah, it sounds lovely. It just depends on where the ice cubes have been.
Yeah.
But anyway, John, by now, being the smart guy that you are, you've guessed that you get exactly the same question. So
yep.
If you were the head of an evil international organization and one of your number twos through to number 12s did something you did not approve of, how would you deal with them?
Well, what I would do is I would combine that scene from Thunderball where the fella's chair gets used to put it, you know, kill him off. But rather than him being sort of explodey Bernie, he'd be dropped below the chair into a mincer, and then I'd turn the mince into a nice chili. But I wouldn't call it chili con carne, I'd call it chili con carnage. a bit of Fry and Laurie joke there for you. But yes, I'd make him a nice chili con carne out of him and probably eat him.
Yeah.
That's a bad
chili con
carne. Eat their own number twos. I mean,
yeah.
Number two.
It was a bit.
When I say number two, I mean in the agency, not your number two. Oh, God.
No, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So it might go right through you, John. Yeah. You don't know.
Number two. That number two, not the. I yeah, just yeah. did a number two, yeah, mummy. Yeah, can yeah. you come and wipe my bum? I might have to edit that bit out or leave it in. So I recognise bits of Thunderball. I watched it yesterday. And I did remember some bits of it. So I obviously had kind of seen it when I was a very, very young child. But yeah, watched it for the first time yesterday. How about you guys? Phil, had you'd seen this one a little while ago, I guess, because again, you kind of got a head start on this whole Bond rewatch thing.
I only actually saw it last week from start to finish on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good just to get some time to myself to actually see it. I mean, I must say this one, the impact that this one had from the start was slightly understated until they brought out the very first gadget, which I'm sure you're going to come to in a second.
Yeah, we will definitely get to the gadgets, that's for sure. So let's have a look. Where are we? Oh, we'll just keep the order of the same, right? Alex.
So I saw it at the start of the month, and then I just recently rewatched it. Part of me forgot that I'd saw it. So when you said, "All right, we're up again, guys," I was like, brilliant, I'll watch it. And then I put it on. I was like, haven't I seen this before? Doesn't this happen? And then I was like, oh, yeah, of course it does. I've watched it already. Yeah. So it's quite a recent watch for me. I'm watching it as we go through. So I'm watching each of them as we go through. And what I've realised is that shorts were shorter then. So maybe we're wearing too long shorts now. I don't know. That might be a matter of opinion, but
you could definitely see in the sort of costuming where Casino Royale paid its little kind of nods to Thunderball. I don't know if it was deliberate, and we'll obviously get to all of that when we get to Casino Royale in about 3 years' time. But I definitely got a lot of that kind of vibe from the trunks. Anyway, look, I'm not going to apologise. It's my job to study the fashion, right? John.
I think I watched it about a month ago. I think we were planned to record earlier, and I watched it in readiness with my other half, actually. And we had seen it before a long, long time ago. So I'll talk more about my reaction to the film later on, but it was not the reaction we expected when we finished watching the film, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally. So this film came out Christmas 1965, so about a year after Goldfinger. Had to think for a second there. But it was originally intended to be the first film in the series. So going back a little bit to the late 50s, so Ian Fleming by now had some recognition with the Bond novels, and Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman were sniffing around the rights to the franchise. And but Fleming already had this vision that he wanted to see Bond on the big screen. So in 1959, he worked with Kevin McClory and Jack Whittingham on a screen treatment, but he got really, really bored through that process. So he up sticks and went back to Jamaica to his home Goldeneye and basically abandoned the project. And he then began writing the next Bond novel entitled Thunderball. And an advanced copy was made available. Kevin McClory saw it and he basically looked at it and said, this is a story that Jack and I co-wrote with you. And he immediately filed a suit against Fleming. So by this time, Cubby and Harry had basically optioned the rights for the franchise, and they wanted to make Thunderball first. But upon consulting with their lawyers said, don't go anywhere near it. Like, pick one of the others, don't do Thunderball. So they put it on the shelf, and as we now know, Dr. No became the very first movie. And in the end, Fleming settled out of court. And then in 1964... just as they were kind of wrapping up Goldfinger, and obviously they wanted to keep the production team together as much as possible because they've been together for three movies now, they managed to make a deal with Kevin McClory. They made him a producer, and he got the screenwriting credit, story credit, alongside Jack Whittingham and Ian Fleming as well. So some challenges for them to overcome very early on. And we move on to casting. So a lot of the original cast return. Bernard Lee as M, the lovely Desmond Llewellyn returns as Q. Sean Connery, obviously by now, is mega famous as James Bond, has really settled into the role as well. Lois Maxwell comes back as Miss Moneypenny. and then we get onto the casting of the new characters. And Domino, who was the main female lead in the film, they considered Raquel Welch, Faye Dunaway and Julie Christie before they found Claudine Auger, I think her name is Auger. Claudine. She got the gig in the end because the producers met with, and I think the director met with Julie Christie because she was kind of on the shortlist. And basically just didn't like her when they met her in real life. So Claudine was a former Miss France. I think she'd done some acting before, but she got the gig. And thank God for that, because she is mighty fine. And that's the one thing that I do remember as a child. I wonder what my was going through my 5-year-old brain to have actually, the one thing that I did remember from this is that the main heroine's name was Domino. But anyhow, there we go. I thought she was really good.
I was just going to say, she didn't do the voice, though.
No, she didn't.
So, she was dubbed over,
She was dubbed over. They also changed her from Italian to French. So that made things a bit interesting. So I kind of think that was probably the reason for dubbing her over later.
They dubbed over most of the cast in this film, didn't they?
Yeah.
They dubbed over Largo as well.
Yeah. It's strange. It's like a technique that they like the look of someone, but just didn't want what they sounded like. So
yeah. But you know, thank God. I mean, if this is a trend that they started off and George Lucas was influenced by it, then thank God for us Star Wars heads that dubbing over actors that you don't like the voice of, because otherwise we'd have got, Luke, I'm your father.
The Green Cross Code Man, just voicing.
Yeah, exactly. So the opening sequence, so now we've established the Bond formula because we start with the gun barrel, etc. Now, again, I tried to look really carefully at this, but I watched it again on iTunes, but this wasn't a 4K restoration, so it was very grainy, and I couldn't see if it kind of looked more like Sean Connery was doing that gun barrel sequence.
It is Sean Connery.
It is. Okay, so that's the first time we see him doing it.
Well, this is the film that set the trend for the actors starring in the films became the dude down the barrel, basically.
Yeah.
I think there was a reason for that, because the way it was filmed. There's actually a valid reason why they chose, rather than using just an unknown model like they do with the girls in the opening sequence, there's a reason why they chose Sean Connery. Well, he's here, let's film him. But it became the de facto character in every film, becomes the gun barrel guy.
Yeah. And then we go straight into the opening sequence. And for this, for the crew, it was all about topping. This is where the tradition of Bond films then comes in, where each new film, they have to top the opening sequence from the previous one. And the opening sequence from Goldfinger was so well received by audiences. They'd never really seen anything like it on big screen. And it had audiences cheering and clapping in theatres up and down the land and across the world. And so they wanted to go for a similar effect here. And so we have this opening sequence at some cathedral or something, and there's someone's funeral and the initials JB are draped over the coffin. And initially you're thinking, what's going on? It's James Bond. But then we see him talking to, I think it's a French agent, and talking about the guy who's been buried, who I think is a Spectre agent, basically. I can't remember his name.
He's Spectre number 6.
Ah, okay. Right. And the widow of the guy that's been buried kind of appears, but then Bond realizes that it's not actually the woman, it's actually the guy that was meant to have been in the coffin. And then there's a massive fight and Bond kills him, and then Bond escapes, and the way that he escapes is he uses a jetpack. Now, yeah. What did we think of this opening sequence in comparison to the one that we saw in Goldfinger, previous movie? Because for me, it was a bit lower impact. Like, I wasn't as excited over it. Alex. Whoever, just jump in. It's a free-for-all.
No, all I was going to say was that you made it pretty clear that it wasn't the widow, because she opened the door herself. And that was what gave it away, that it wasn't the widow. And that's how he got straight into that fight sequence. I think the only reason it didn't create enough of an impact for me was only because I'd seen that so many other times before. It kind of reminded me of Austin Powers, whereas that's not a woman, that's a man. And so it was just like, I wanted to kind of watch it from, with my eyes closed, and not seeing it before, but because I'd seen it so many times before, it became, oh yeah, well, this is expected, but I'm sure it had a lot more impact at the time. But there was certainly where the impact came was straight away when I saw the jetpack. It was just, you know, I just thought he's not going to actually fly that, and he did. And I mean, I'm sure at the time it was incredible. I mean, I've looked into that a little bit more. And apparently the guy that actually flew it was one of only two people in the world that was qualified to actually fly it.
It's Bill Suter that flew it, wasn't it?
Bill, yeah, well, that's it. Yeah, that's the name. Yeah,
so the rocket pack, it was developed for army use, and Phil's absolutely right. Only two pilots in the whole world were qualified to fly the thing. And the first guy basically asked him to fly it without a crash helmet because they thought that's what Bond would do. And he basically said, "You're absolutely nuts. I'm not. There's no way that I'm going to do that." And so the other guy got the job. And so he actually flew the thing, and it's a 21-second flight. And it's a real working gadget that was used by the army at the time.
But he wore a helmet. He had to put a helmet on. So he was wearing a helmet.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. No, he was wearing a helmet. See, what? Before I talk about how I felt about it, John, how what was your reaction when you saw that opening sequence?
Oh, I enjoyed it. I mean, I think it follows a similar theme with Bond. I mean, just doing something that ends up being a part of the mission. You know, it starts off quiet. Oh, right, what's going on? And then he's into action straight away. But I'm trying to put myself into the mind of a 1965 viewer, and that jetpack must have just blown their minds, because the special effects of the 60s just wasn't good enough to show that as if it was a trick with back projection or anything. So that would have blown my mind, I think. And I think that's why they got it out. You know, let's go in straight away with a real cool gadget, and more gadgets later on. I thought it was quite humorous. The widow was definitely a female actor at the beginning of the sequence, and then it reminded me a bit of the two Roddies the bit where he's kind of tussling in the fireplace, and you can see like proper men's hairy legs in fishnets. It was quite funny. It kind of a bit of comedic value to it, really. Oh yeah, it's a bloke, you know. So it made me titter a bit, you know. It was quite funny.
It reminded me of the Sheila's Wills character out of not Little Britain. What's the other one called? You know, the Inside Number 9 guys, the one that they used to do, Royston Vasey. League of Gentlemen, that was it. Yeah. And you got the cross-dressing sort of mid, you know, trans op taxi driver.
Yeah. Barbara.
That's it. Yeah.
I knew you wouldn't let me down. You're taking it away and giving me a womb. Anyway, where are you going?
Yeah, totally un-PC these days. But anyway, Alex. How was the jetpack for you? Were you like, oh my God, I want one of those?
It was a bit ridiculous, to be honest. But again, I'm trying to get my head into the 60s mindset. I was just surprised that we didn't see him in bed with anyone before the credits. Because he got in bed with lots of people after the credits. But normally you see him in a hotel room, and this wasn't a hotel room at all. This was him out on location. But the fight sequence was quite fun. I did enjoy that. I think it felt more amped up than any of the previous ones. You know, it did feel like, you know, whatever they would do would be bigger than the last one. That kind of set the tone, I guess.
Yeah, there was a little bit of excitement, though. I mean, as for the, you thought he would bed someone before the opening credits, I thought he was going to bed the widow when he walked in. But obviously he then realised that she was a bloke. So
he got an offer from his, like, the agent that was there as well, like maybe later or whatever it was. And I was just like, all right, okay, he's off to a quick start. And I was thinking, all right, okay, we'll see where this goes. And then it's like, no, he's fussed. He's more fussed about killing the dead guy. So, I was, okay, all right then.
It's funny, isn't it? Like John Wick's all about the body count, and with Bond, it's all about the bed count. I totally agree with you guys. You've got to get your head into a 1965 audience member and what they would or wouldn't have seen before this. You know, we're very spoilt nowadays with computer technology and, you know, just the amazing special effects that we see in movies now. But, you know, it was like that rocket thing didn't really take off that fast. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't exactly Iron Man. And they caught up to him pretty quick, and he was well within shooting range. So what really should have happened is that film should have ended about 10 seconds after he took off from the roof with him blowing up. But it didn't. So, and then when he lands, it must have taken it, because I know trying to stick the shopping in the back of my Mini, right? And that Aston Martin boot is not that much bigger. I was saying to Carolina, I was like, it's going to take him longer to take that off, take the helmet off, do his hair again, and then try and shove the thing into the back of that Aston Martin when he's got the bulletproof shield probably taking up space in there. And then don't forget the oil tank, if they've gone and packed that one as well. Turns out they hadn't. They changed it to a water jet. That, by the way, was two fire hoses that were rigged underneath the Aston Martin through the exhaust system, and then they basically just turned them on when it was time for him to... But then it was quite exciting when you saw the Aston Martin and straight away the bulletproof screen comes up.
It's that
hark back to the amazing car we saw in the last film. And you're right. Okay, great. We're back. You know, we're back. The old crew's back together. Let's enjoy the ride.
I had that car, yeah. Bobby, as a child.
What, as in the actual full car?
No, as a toy.
Or the toy one.
Yeah, you could press like buttons on the bumper and it would push up the bulletproof shield, and I think I'm pretty sure my one had an ejector seat. I'm not sure if that was used in this film, but it was proper metal, like proper. It was a good quality toy, very heavy Bond car. I used to play with that. So when I saw the car in the film, I thought, "Wow, it's my toy car."
So, John, where is that car now?
I don't know. I think it's probably in landfill, which is a shame because it's probably worth a few bob. If I kept the box for it, it's a bit like that person whoever nicked the Bond's watch offset. You know, the Breitling he wore for this film. That went missing, and it got found in someone's loft somewhere, or like a. In fact, he bought this. Some guy bought it from a junk fair for £25, and got sold at Sotheby's for about 100,000. God, imagine that, eh? Anyway, I'm not sure my car would have been worth the same as that, but there you go.
We then get to the title credits. This was just, I'm not even going to spend any time on it. It was so underwhelming. It was just silhouettes of people swimming around, which gave you a big clue as to what the majority of this movie was going to end up being.
The soundtrack was fantastic, though. This is the best soundtrack so far.
The overall soundtrack, yeah, but Thunderball is, I was saying to Carolina, it's actually one of my least favourite Bond themes because it doesn't evoke that whole kind of Bond sort of bravado. I don't know what it is. I mean, I know that John Barry, the theme comes in a little bit more. But yeah, I just Thunderball's just not one of those songs that I think of when you ask me to name Bond theme songs. It's not that it's bad, but...
This has been my favourite so far, but then I think that Tom Jones's voice is amazing and it still has the lyrics by Don Black, which keeps the same theme as Goldfinger in terms of how it's written and how the lyrics are really kind of like pushed towards the viewer. I think this is, so far, this is my favourite one out of all of the songs so far.
Yeah.
Apparently Tom Jones really fainted at the end of the song. You know, he has that sort of 9 second sort of high note right at the end recording it. Apparently he really fainted.
So that's
devotion to a cause, isn't it, really?
Yeah. I used the second half of the title sequence to, you know, sort the dogs out and make sure that they weren't going to bark through the rest of the film. So title sequence, then we meet, what's his face? Eye patch guy. So Carolina's like, okay. is this Is it Largo? Is this going to be the is this the villain? And I said, well, he's wearing an eye patch in a Bond movie. Obviously, it's going to be the villain.
No question about it. Is
there? I don't know what your other halves thought, but you know, Carolina then proceeded to give a running commentary. Okay, so he gets out of his car, and then the parking ticket guy tells him he can't park there, and he completely ignores him, and then he walks into this place. And then he looks around and he's got a little gadget. And oh, yes, he's got a secret. He's got a secret compartment that leads into somewhere else.
She's not going to do this on
Friday, is she? Huh?
She's not.
No, no.
Good.
In the cinema. She might be asking questions throughout the film.
We'll sit her next to you.
Next to Alex, who's already seen it by then.
You guys are in J5, J6, 7, 8, and 9. And I'm in... like Z5.
Oh, that's cheeky. You booked it as well, so you can't say sorry. You know, that's what you intended.
It is what I intended.
You might as well have put it in the bar.
It was part of my grand design, Alex. So then we go into basically a board meeting with Spectre. So, interesting fact here, right? Blofeld, do you remember Professor Dent, I think his name was, in Doctor No? Mr. Sweaty, take the tarantula to kill Bond with it. So he is actually the physical form of Blofeld in this film and in the last one, but voiced by the guy that voices Blofeld. There'll be other Bond enthusiasts listening to this that will be screaming the actual voice of Blofeld's name at me, but I'm sorry, I can't remember. It's Tuesday and I'm tired. But yeah, the actor who played Professor Dent in the first Bond movie is the physical form of Blofeld in Goldfinger and in this film. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And he's got his minions there. So number two is Largo, and then we proceed basically down, and he's asking them. I guess they're all basically saying what their contribution to Spectre is has been the highlight of the week, right?
Don't kill me, I've done this.
Exactly.
Okay, all right.
That's like the monthly earnings report, isn't it, really?
Yeah, exactly.
So how were your sales targets? You know what I mean?
And obviously we get to, I can't remember what numbers they were, but 8 and 9 or whatever, but their KPIs haven't been met. So one of them's been fiddling the books or something, and Blofeld gets really, really angry, and he then has his little sort of switch pad there next to him with his little toggle switches, and he flicks one of them. How does a guy die? Does he get electrocuted?
He gets electrocuted.
He vaporizes, doesn't he?
He's electrocuted, then his seat goes down.
Into the minty machine for my lasagna.
Yeah. We don't hear that. It's obviously got good sound insulation. But yeah, and then he just his dusty chair comes back up.
Yeah.
But I mean, I found it hilarious. I imagine the audiences back then would have been horrified. Maybe.
This is one of the main sequences that must have influenced Mike Myers for his, you know, the scenes in Austin Powers. Again, we've said this before in Bond podcasts, Austin Powers has ruined our appreciation of the original Bond films because the parodies are so hilarious. But it just reminded me of that scene in the cave.
Yeah. No, totally.
Yeah.
But this is where number two then tells everybody about his plan to steal these two nukes so that they can hold the world at ransom. And then it cuts to Health Spa. And this is pretty much where Bond spends a lot of the next kind of what felt like third of the film before anything else kind of moved out of there. I don't know where it was filmed, but it was presumably somewhere in Eton. England. England.
Pinewood.
It's called Troublands, the actual resort, isn't it?
Yeah.
The health spa's called Troublands.
Yeah, there was obviously some location shots, but then most of it was shot in Pinewood, just on a stage.
Yeah. So we get our pussy galore moment, I'm going to call it, where he tries to force himself onto the assistant nurse, whatever she is, therapist, which again was kind of a bit uncomfortable viewing in Patricia? The modern era.
Is that Patricia?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Patricia,
played by Molly Peters.
But he's, I think he's having a physical or an assessment, isn't he? Because yeah. She's kind of studying all the bruises and you know, body damage that he's taken. So it's very much like Pierce Brosnan in, I want to say GoldenEye, because he's kind of undergoing a physical, isn't he, in the opening of one of those. But anyway, I skip ahead a year and a half or so. And then he gets changed. And he's on the phone, and I can't remember what the hell was going on. But I do remember the suit that he's wearing. And this is a guy who makes wearing earth tones really cool. Because he's wearing a brown, what looks like a flannel suit. The cut's different from the last film in that the top button position on these things is lower. Anyone listening at home, I'm doing the tailoring bit, okay? This is what I get paid for. So the top button position is lower, much, much lower. I mean, the top button on these jackets is almost at belly button level, which is considered to be quite a sort of 60s American kind of look. And it's not one that I've ever liked because I don't think it's very flattering, but he seems to kind of wear it quite well. But he's wearing brown and he's wearing a beige shirt, and then he's got a really dark brown or black tie, and he just looks amazing. I still think Connery's tailoring is about the best of the entire series. They do a really, really good job. And also it looks practical. It looks like he could actually move and hit people in it. So the next thing, he's stripped off again. I think going back to Alex's point about shorts in the 60s, I think towels in the 60s were extremely small. There wasn't any such thing as a big sort of bath towel. They were just using hand towels for just about everything. And he tries to molest the assistant, Patricia. And so Patricia, sorry, and she proceeds to strap him into that rack thing. And I've got no idea what that was for. But Phil, you've been to a spa.
It was kind of like a stretching the spine sort of thing, wasn't it? Really, just sort of. Yeah. Like a sort of a auto calisthenics machine, like a sort of stretch the muscles for you.
I thought he was like dry humping it at some points because it didn't look particularly when they racked up the speed. I was just like, no, that's not appropriate. No,
what do you mean when they sped the film up? You mean?
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, the icing on the cake would have been if you'd just seen his eyes cross over.
That's why I passed out. Oh dear, we've gone there already.
But I mean the reason why, so he's on the torture rack thing, right, having his spine stretched out, and then she goes, and then the other guy, the Spectre agent, comes in. I think he's number six actually, and he basically just whacks it up to full speed, doesn't he? And then Bond basically passes out. She manages to come back in and unchain him from there. And he recovers his energy really, really quickly. Because I don't know about you guys, but I would not have the energy for going into a sauna and doing it after that. I would just want to go lie down and curl up and just have a nice good old sleep. Wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, what I was struck by, after that happens, she's concerned that she's going to lose his job. And to me, the way it worked, the line that she used was, oh, you wouldn't tell, I could lose my job. And he goes, well, it could be bought, you know. And it's like, it just, to me, it reminded me of what 70s porn films must have got their scripts. You know, it's like, I'm going to have to let you go. No, don't let me go. I'll do anything to keep my job. Ooh, anything. And then, wah, 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 you know, and it goes straight into it, you know. And it's just, and the thing was that she was like sexually assaulted previously, but then all of a sudden after they have sex in that steam room, she's completely let go. And later on, she's being caressed with mink.
Oh, yes.
Makes no sense.
Yeah. That's sort of afterplay rather than foreplay, isn't it, really, I suppose?
It's really concerning.
Yes.
Yeah. I turned around to see and I said, he just blackmailed her into having sex, didn't he?
Yes.
She was like very disapproving. Yep, he did. I'm calling the police right now. He then kind of gets his revenge on the guy because the guy's in, right, so here's another one, right? The guy's head sticking out of this contraption. It's only his head sticking out the top. What was that thing?
It's a steamer. It's a personal steamer, wasn't it?
Yep.
I think back in the 60s, there was a lot of beliefs, a bit like the old Victorian belief, that if you heat the body up and strap it in and seal it, it'll just automatically lose weight. Like, it'll shrink wrap myth about if you shrink wrap your body, you just sweat yourself weight off. So I think that was to do with it. I mean, it could have been more like a Roman sauna, you know, the Caldarium, where you heat your body up after a cold shower or something. But I was convinced that there was another film with this in where Bond gets trapped in it himself. But maybe it was this film.
I can't remember it.
For some reason, I think it's a Pierce Brosnan one.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure.
Where he
sure.
gets trapped in a sauna.
Yeah, something
or
like
something.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get to that at some point in the next couple of years, John. So anyway, so now we start moving the story along, because then we're suddenly introduced to the villainess of the piece, Fiona Volpe, who was played by Luciana Paluzzi. And I thought she was absolutely brilliant. Redhead, absolutely gorgeous. So there's this pilot, basically, who turns up and then he gets killed. And they've basically done plastic surgery on one of their agents to look exactly like him so that he can then infiltrate the military to then steal one of their planes that's carrying these two bombs that they want to nick so that they can hold the world to ransom. So that happens. And she's quite cold-blooded as well. Mm-hmm. What did we think of this whole thing?
Well, she's a very alluring character and actually quite unusual for a Bond film, I thought, this sort of strong female character that's actually, you know, attractive as well. I mean, there are other female Bond hench women, like the lady with the spikes in her shoes, which are kind of portrayed as almost sort of non-gender specific in some ways. And she was very much, a temptress, wasn't she, really? I think she was a bit two-dimensional. I'd like to have seen her character develop more. But, you know, this is a 1960s Bond film. We're not going to see much of that, are we? But I thought she was very, a very interesting character who was very much devoted to Spectre, I think. That was her main focus.
Mm. Yeah, extremely. The thing that amuses me is that they've got those octopus rings that are not very subtle, are they? I mean, you're supposed to be part of this secret organisation, kind of sneaking around, infiltrating, getting up to all of your nefarious deeds. But then you've got this massive ring, like an NFL ring. So then we go back to the health club again because Bond is still there. And they've shipped off the dead body of the poor pilot. And Bond's kind of examining it, works out that it's him and he's dead. And then they try and kill him in there, but then they don't succeed. And then we cut to the sequence where they actually get hold of the nuke. So Spectre agent, who's had plastic surgery to look like pilot, basically gets onto the fighter jet thing, and he's been given this canister, so he isolates himself from the oxygen supply and he kills everyone. And there was a slight continuity error, I thought, there, because when he is asked by the co-pilot, do you want to take the co-pilot's seat, and he says yes, and they swap, the guy who was the co-pilot then goes down to join the others, but he's eating a sandwich. And there is no way that he would have had the time to eat the sandwich and suddenly be sat there with his mask on to then be killed. So I'm not even sure Sandwich Guy was actually killed by gas. So, like, what happened to Sandwich Guy? Am I the only person that noticed this?
Maybe he was eating the sandwich inside the mask.
Ah, so you mean he sort of shoved it in mouth, right? And
I've got to get back to work. I'll put it in my mouth, and then, like, you know, a bit like, you know, when you have a quick sandwich in the car whilst you're driving, which you shouldn't really do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Driving with one hand.
You know. Plot holes didn't really come to mind in this particular film because it's not a lot to take serious about this film, is there?
Don't forget, he's already like tried to renegotiate his fees for this, hasn't he? As well for this heist.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, right? I mean, we all thought it, didn't we? As soon as he does that, you're thinking back to what, you know, Blofeld did to number 9 or whatever. And you're thinking, this guy's basically just signed his death warrant. There's no way they're going to let him out of this alive. So
but she thought quickly. She did think quickly about his demands because they did realise there was no one else could do it. He spent 2 years studying for it. So she basically said, yeah, okay, fine. Just think of it as a down payment. So then they just basically let it go. And then later on, we discover his fate.
Yeah.
Don't betray Spectre number 1.
But then this is where we see where the money, the budget on this film has just gone through the roof in comparison to the previous installments. Because I think they spent $9 million dollars on this.
This film cost the same as all the previous Bond films put together.
Right. So there you go. So that, you know, this fighter jet then sort of lands on a, because they're like, oh, we need the underwater lights or underwater runway lights to come up. And you're just like, what? I mean, he builds a runway underwater. That's not a thing, is it?
It turns out it's not really. Bob, it'll be a subcontractor who then gets killed off, probably.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's just a shallow archipelago, so it's not like right, you've got to do a lot of work. Yeah. You could run a cable down that pretty easily. Yeah. I mean, I don't have the specs, obviously.
You want to get in contact with Keith's underwater lights.
Yeah.
They're a company that put underwater lights in for you.
Nice.
Because sometimes you have to be really careful what you ask and wish for on this podcast because, you know, ask and you shall receive what you weren't asking for. Thanks, guys. I made note of all of those. So, you know, when I sort the underwater lights out in the ocean behind my new house, I'll be sure to give Keith some
call. Or in your bath.
But this was a very long sequence because the plane goes down and then... from underneath the Disco Volante, which is, what's his face? What's the villain's name? Eye patch.
Largo.
Largo's yacht. Isn't it? Yeah, so they kind of launch from underneath their Aqualung thing, and then Largo basically dives down. What's his face is stuck in the cockpit and can't get the belt off, and Largo basically cuts his air supply and kills him. And then they cover the plane up with a camouflage net so it can't be seen from the surface. And then the whole scene for me just took such a long time. And I imagine back then it would have been very, very exciting and so on, but I just thought they could have made it a little bit more concise because we literally see the whole taking the Aqualung off of the boat and then going down and then unloading the nukes. Amusingly, which have a very specific instruction on them that says handle like eggs. I don't know if that's what nukes have in real life. Anyone send a message to Moscow and ask them?
Probably not a good time to do that, to be honest, Roberto.
This is true. Yeah. But I just thought the underwater sequence, and it same goes for a lot of the underwater sequences in this film, I just thought they were so protracted. Did anyone else fall asleep during this?
But that was the gimmick, wasn't it? That was the thing. They weren't used to that much use of underwater. They were like, hey, we've got an underwater camera and we can make it look really good. And so that's why you used it all the time. But of course, when you're underwater, you can't go very fast. I thought the editing was pretty good, but it was just, you know, you can't do an action sequence underwater and keep it compelling. It's always a lot of like just watching, really. You're like, oh right, they're going over there, oh they're going over here, oh okay, I guess that, I mean, it's the kind of thing that your wife would be great at voicing over, Bobby, so because she'd be like, oh well, they've forgotten to do that, oh well, we've got to sort that out, and they look good, yeah, they forgot to do their thing up properly, so they're gone. That kind of thing. So,
did anyone else understand why when the pilot went down, he couldn't get himself free from his fasteners.
I think that was just a lucky coincidence for Largo's crew.
Yeah, it wasn't. Okay. It wasn't clear that it had been sabotaged.
It may have been sabotaged. You're right.
It could have been, but it wasn't really clear that that had happened. And I think because also they were on the scene pretty quickly, so I think they were going to kill him either way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. He was definitely dead. I think it was just lucky for Largo that he was stuck there, so it just made it easier for Largo. But I mean, with regards to the nukes, so the special effects crew, they actually did go on tour of a real naval or air base or whatever. I don't know what you call an air base. Is it a naval base? No, naval submarines and stuff, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But anyway, they went on a tour of some military installation.
You do have nukes in submarines, don't you? To be fair, that's where they generally launch from.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Trident is all on submarines.
I mean, this was filmed in NASA, wasn't it? So that there's a naval base near NASA anyway.
Yeah.
I may just pop down to NASA to have a look at it.
I didn't even know what Trident was. I thought Trident was something like, you know, the Duke of Edinburgh scheme that you used to do at school, that sort of thing. I thought Trident was just another one of them.
Yeah, you don't get a badge for it.
But they basically took secret pictures of everything that they were being shown, so that, and then they sneaked the footage back to Pinewood so that they could recreate all of the stuff that they saw, you know, the cockpit of the fighter jet, the bombs and everything. So I thought that was quite an interesting little bit of trivia there. So they've stolen the nukes. Then we go back to Bond again, and this is where we kind of get the first sort of car chase, because Spectre agent number 6 or whatever, who's at the health club, basically comes after Bond. And before Bond can start working out which of the gadgets on the Aston Martin he's going to use, what's her name? Fiona basically comes up on a motorbike, launches a rocket off it, and blows the absolute bejesus out of the other guy, because Spectre have already given the instruction that he needs to be killed, because Blofeld didn't like the way that he handled whatever it was that he didn't handle properly.
Yeah.
So that stunt man that was doubling for Fiona, he was going at 100 miles an hour when at the point he launches that rocket. So it was filmed at Silverstone, and the stuntman Bob Simmons, who was in the car that gets blown up, basically it obviously exploded, and they weren't expecting it to explode in that way. And for a few seconds after the explosion, he didn't emerge. So they weren't sure if he was stuck under the car or whatever. So the crew wanted to obviously rush out there to make sure he was okay. But the director kept the film running and basically didn't call cut. And so he kept it going. Yeah, he admits to this. He's like, directors are cold-blooded, basically. So he just let it keep running until he was happy that he'd got the shot that he wanted. Then let the crew go. And then luckily Bob Simmons had managed to make it out just before he caught fire himself. But it was a pretty hairy stunt, that one. Very big explosion as well.
He had a bit of a hairy time all in, because he was also the stuntman that had to swim with the sharks as Bond, didn't he? Because I think they placed some like Perspex panels in the pool for Bond, so he could swing alongside them. But then they realised that the Perspex panels were like 3 foot high, and the sharks were just swimming over the top, because sharks can swim in water above things and below things, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So we're skipping a little bit forward, but while we're talking about the Perspex, so basically, yeah, because Sean Connery didn't want to be in the swimming pool with the sharks, understandably. So the director convinced him, and they were like, you know, don't worry, we're going to put Perspex. So you'll be on one side, plexiglass rather, and the sharks will be on the other side. And unless the shark, and this is exactly what the director described, how he described it to Sean Connery, unless the sharks can suddenly turn into dolphins and jump up out of the water and over the plexiglass onto the other side, you're going to be perfectly safe. What they didn't tell Sean Connery is they were short of plexiglass. So there was a 4 foot wide gap in the plexiglass. And that scene, the moment where Connery sort of has to move out of the way of one of the sharks, that was real. Like, his reaction was real and everything. It was just happened that that shark found the 4 foot gap and swam through it. And Connery was not impressed. He got out of the pool straight away and he was just like, I'm not doing that again. So anyway, there
I
we
don't
go.
I don't blame him. I think I'd do the same, to be fair.
Yeah, no, exactly. We'll come on to the Bob Simmons guy. So a bit of Alex's favourite bit of special effects. We go to MI6 and basically all the 00 agents have been called and they're basically talking about these two nukes have gone missing and they've got a tape from Spectre that they're about to play to them with the ransom demands of $100 million in diamonds or they're going to blow up an unnamed UK or US city. Turns out it was Miami in the end. And then a painting goes up.
Huh? That's it. Yeah.
You win some. Well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. but a painting goes up and we get one of Alex's favourite ever special effects from the early Bond films because he absolutely loved the satellite navigation technology in the Aston Martin. And this was quite similar. A static painting on the wall.
Yeah,
it was an oddly specific thing to set up for one reveal, wasn't it? In a like a massive wall of fairly sort of opulent, stately home type space. It was just so bizarre.
It's odd because they also were like, you know, how would we put all of the 00s together? Well, clearly we're going to be in a really grand conference room, and you're thinking. Why would that be the case?
But the other thing I felt was it was significant was there were also it was supposed to be a secret lair, but there was a massive window, so anyone could have actually seen who was in there and the big reveal from a neighbouring enemy state that might have wanted to kind of figure out what UK's plans were.
I mean, you could put like the Alex from the one show in front on a sofa, couldn't you? And you could film there.
Oh yeah, it's good background.
Yeah,
that would work.
Or just bring Fiona along with a rocket launcher and just shoot through the window.
Yeah, but on all seriousness, one thing about this, what really takes it back to 1965 was they revealed that they wanted $100 million. UK pound sterling, which at the time was worth $280 million.
Wow.
So this was before the period when the UK devalued the pound. So it was before that whole period of our history when we devalued the pound, and the dollar was worth so much more back then.
Phil's
we're doing that again.
Yeah, Phil's becoming our little resident chief economist, isn't he? All these little fun currency facts. You did it in Goldfinger as well.
Well, you've got
Phil,
to
I think we're going to give you a regular slot, Phil.
These films, though, they're historical records, aren't they?
Mm.
So it is fascinating to compare the finances of the time compared to now. I think you're right. Phil should crack on with that for every episode because I find that really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, me too. And another historical record. So we see M sort of briefing some major or whatever, and then Bond is there, and Bond explains that he's seen Pilot Dude dead, so he's not alive and well. So it means that there's a decoy out there, Derval, and who obviously transpires is Domino's brother, and Bond has a picture of Domino because obviously he's found it in the file. She's very attractive. And he basically, like a little child or dog with a bone, insists that M sends him to Nassau. And then there's this lovely little exchange, these little exchanges that we're coming to really love between, Bernard Lee and Sean Connery. And he's like, Connery's like, you got to let me go to Nassau. And Bernard Lee, M is... and what's in Nassau? Is it the girl? Yes. Where is she? In Nassau. It's something like that anyway. But it's just hilarious to just watch that little interchange between them. And then Bond gets his wish and he gets sent to... Oh, God, John, stop doing that. So we're on Skype, guys and girls. And what the guys love to do is just put pictures of things that distract me. and distract me they have, because now we're going to talk about Domino. So this is where we first meet her. Bond's on a speedboat with a CIA agent who's also extremely attractive. They just seem by this time, I'm counting at least four, if not five, very attractive Bond girls. So they basically amped the Bond girl ratio up for this.
It's Paula, the brunette. Yeah.
Who? Yes, and she was also one of the gypsy girls from Russia with Love.
Was she?
Yeah.
Martine Beswick.
Yeah, she was one of the gypsy girls that were fighting over Bond in From Russia with Love. What they had to do was they basically kept her in Nassau for like 2-3 weeks, get her really tanned to make her look like she was native. But they just basically...
I remember I saw an interview with the actress and she said that, you know, when she got there, basically she was told that she was so pale. So she had a very early morning call time every single day where her job basically was to sit in the sun as soon as it got hot enough and just basically tan herself until she was nice and brown. What a life. I mean, speaking of which, the cast and crew said that they had a really, really good time on this film. And part of that was the director, because he really liked, he enjoyed a drink and enjoyed getting everyone together on the yacht for drinks at the end of shooting every day. But Sean Connery is the one who made the biggest difference, apparently. He was really involved. He was really enthusiastic. He was heavily involved with bringing the cast and crew together and keeping morale up and so on. So, and he was really invested in this film. He really wanted this film to do well and to...
Which he did.
Which it did extremely, yeah. I mean, I think adjusted for inflation, it's still the most successful Bond film to date. I don't know how it stacks up against... what was the billion-dollar... Skyfall. I don't know how it stacks up against Skyfall.
If you measure it success, you have to measure it as profits in North America.
Versus budget as well.
Because the
thing is, the budget versus profit for this was really high compared to... Like, you know, it might be really popular, but, you know, they would have spent $100 million on it these days, whereas
box office that's not what they spent. $41 million, which in the 60s is just a phenomenal amount of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, extremely. So so they try and make another assassination attempt on Bond. Like, Spectre are really going for it. They really don't like him. But we meet Felix Leiter, and we're four films in now. And the actor's changed again.
But Bobby, this actor's name's brilliant.
I know. Yeah, I'll let you. Go on, John. What's his name?
Rick Van Nutter. I mean, if I could choose any name, any stage name, Rick Van Nutter. And it is Nutter spelt the correct way as well. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Properly. So he's the third actor now to play Felix Leiter in just four films. But I thought he was quite good. You know, he was an adequate CIA American foil to Bond's, you know, suave, sophisticated. But the agent who tries to kill Bond this time completely fails and Bond duffs him up and then sends him on his way. And then Largo has him killed by a shark, Alex's favourite method. And stuntman... They literally had the stuntman dive bomb onto this poor shark's head to then get the shark thrashing around in the pool. And the stunt guy asked for an extra $250 of danger money to do that. I mean, how much money would it take for you to dive bomb onto a tiger shark's head? Nothing, John's saying.
No amount of money.
Not doing it.
I can't swim in swimming pools on my own still. At the age of 48, I still cannot swim in a swimming pool on my own. Because I had this childhood fear of Jaws. Yeah, well, I watched Jaws when I was a child, and I could never go in pools on my own at all. Yeah. I always thought there was a shark in the corner of the pool, so I could never swim on my own.
I get that.
Irrational fear.
No, not really. I couldn't really go to the toilet on my own for quite some time because I thought Jaws would come out of the toilet bowl.
Does that ever happen? That's
different, I think.
It never happened in any of the Jaws movies, but it was just water, and sharks can get everywhere, right? Phil's known me a very long time, but this one thing about this,
that's for sure.
I've seen The Ring. Oh my god, The Ring, that haunted me for ages. And you know, my sister, she had long dark hair. You remember Zarina, Phil?
Yeah.
But she would do that. She'd basically just knock on the door in the middle of the night, but she'd put her nightdress on backwards and then have the hair sort of all sort of wet and slicked and absolutely scare the living daylights out of me.
Sadistic.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, extremely. Anyway, bad guy gets killed by shark, and then we finally get our Q branch moment because Q arrives in Nassau to give Bond his gadgets, and Bond keeps fiddling around with the sort of submarine-like jetpacky type thing that's got missiles and stuff on it. We find out later.
For goodness sake, Desmond Bond, pay attention.
Exactly. Desmond Llewellyn just does a great job of interpreting the director's instructions for the character that he was given in Goldfinger. So we're going to play a bit of Generation Game, Bond gadget version. So what gadgets does Bond receive? And there aren't as many this time around as there were in Goldfinger, which was a bit disappointing. But let's go, let's start with Alex, because he's got a right cheeky smile on his face.
So the first one is a Geiger counter disguised as a camera. Oh no, have I got time, John? Are you pointing to a watch? There's a gun, a flare gun.
Okay.
I'm getting
okay.
I'm
getting it's only Alex maths. Playing this game today.
Yeah, it's only me. So rebreather. Yep, good. What else does he get?
Bananas.
Oh, no.
Whiskey.
So it looks like a shot of tequila or something that Bobby was doing. So
it's a vodka martini, surely. Chocolate.
No, the tracking device.
It's the homing tracking beacon. Device.
That looks like a tablet.
Beacon. Distress beacon. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was it. Up. That was all he got.
No, he didn't get a lot this time, did he?
Yeah.
Is it nuclear? And if it's nuclear, tell us and we'll send the heavies in.
I think the major gadgets with regards to the underwater equipment are shown off much later in the film, as we'll discuss later.
Well, he's got a pretty kick-ass underwater spear gun thing as well, isn't he, at some point?
Later in the film.
Yeah.
That's true.
So that's that. And then, you know, MI6 basically are up in arms because it looks like they're probably going to end up having to pay this ransom. The Home Office has just said, if you can't recover those nukes, then we're paying it, guys. And they're not happy about that. And I don't think Bond is either, because he basically then is, right, okay, you know, give me my diving equipment. I'm going to go and have a look at Largo's yacht and see what's going on. And he almost comes a cropper because they catch him and start throwing grenades at him, which is lovely when you're going for a night swim. That's just all you need, isn't it? A few hand grenades being thrown at your head. He does get to use... Yeah, exactly. He does get to use the underwater camera, though.
He does, yeah.
Yeah, so at least there's that. But then when he manages to get out of that situation, this is where he meets Fiona for, I think, the first time. She picks him up in her car, and he asks if she's going to Nassau, and she says yes, although she's kind of taking a long route around it. And this is where we kind of sort of get a sense of what she's like, really. You could almost see she's the sort of blueprint for Xenia on a top in GoldenEye in some ways. Did anyone else get that vibe?
I can see the similarity.
It's the big sort of leather cat suit, isn't it, really? That similar sort of outfit that she wears to on a top.
Yeah. She's basically a bit mental. And, yeah. She basically just after this, she tells Largo that she is going to kill Bond, like it will be done and she'll be the one to do it. And then Bond basically has an invite to Largo's villa with the two shark swimming pools. And while he's there, that's where the other CIA agent, the lady, gets killed. The one who was in the Gypsy Village in From Russia with Love.
Yeah, Paula.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was quite sad.
Yeah.
I thought it was quite sudden as well. But then this is where we get to the whole, this kind of carnival thing, street carnival that's going on. And Bond has... Now, junk see, canoe. I missed some...
Junk canoe, that's right.
The junk canoe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Junk canoe? Is that a junk footballer?
Junk canoe, that's what it's called.
It's called a junk canoe.
Okay.
It's a Caribbean thing, isn't it? They celebrate it on Boxing Day or something, don't they?
Mm.
Yeah. It reminded me so a bit it's not of like a Mardi Gras, really.
Yes.
But yeah.
A Caribbean version of it, so...
Yeah. The closest thing we have to it is the Notting Hill Carnival.
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay.
I mean, but also we have, if you know, if you're a white British man, we've also got Morris dances. Because I was out watching Morris dances this weekend, and there were a couple of young security guards who'd obviously been like, you know, some temp agency. Both guys from London, both black guys from London, who turned around to me. I walked past them at one point, and I could just overhear what they were saying, and they were just looking, both of them looking incredulously at Morris dancing. One was like, "What's this in it?" And the other guy goes, "Some white man shit in it, mate." And just walked off. I'm sorry for that kind of word, but I thought, yeah, you're right. Yeah, pretty much is. Old guys with beards and feathers in their hair drinking ale and dancing with bells on their toes. Yeah.
John, did you see some shin kicking as well while you were there?
Yeah, lots of sticks being, lots of people hitting each other sticks and shin kicking and blokes with bladders on balloons and yeah.
Right.
I'm very proud to be British after that. Anyway, John Canoe, back to John Canoe.
Yeah, so Bond ends up there because Largo tells him to escort Domino there because Largo can't make it for some reason. But I think the reason is so that they can assassinate Bond and have their fourth or fifth attempt at it. So I think, that's it. So Felix basically calls Bond from the balcony and then tells him that the other lady's been killed. And then Fiona and her heavies go after Bond. Now, he's got a leg injury, and that's the bit I missed. Did he get shot?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He actually got shot in the back of the calf?
Yeah.
Okay, how the hell is he still able to move? And how does he heal so quickly?
He's Bond. Well, you know, he does a lot of saltwater swimming, Bobby, and I personally, from experience, I've injured myself and... suffered months of antibiotics, but then jumped into salt water and it healed within minutes. Salt water is very healing. That's what it is.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Bobby, on that note, you know, if I ever get shot in the leg and you're with me, I want you to piss on my leg.
Why?
Because salt water is going to be healing, and then it means you'll save my life.
That's ammonia.
It's not some weird sort of golden shower fetish that you've got, Phil.
I thought you'd do that for jellyfish.
Oh, it's for jellyfish. Oh, right.
I mean, look, what you do in the comfort of your own home is not my concern.
Yeah, I was wondering. I knew that was a thing for jellyfish. Well, it was just that for a gunshot wound, you want me to pee on your leg. Weirdo.
Well, I thought salt water and piss might have the same effect, but I guess not.
We can try.
What makes you think my pee is like salt water?
I'm just saying, if you were with me, we go back a long time.
I'm so confused right now.
I'm really confused as well. So anyway, moving on.
But
you would
do it, Bobby, for him. You would do it. You would.
No, not for a gunshot wound. For a gunshot wound, I'd make a tourniquet and tie it above the wound, first of all. Okay. And then I'd try and find something to get the bullet out of his leg. But I certainly wouldn't piss on his leg. That's the last thing I'd do.
Okay.
Shit, honestly. So,
anything but not that.
So now he escapes that, right? And he ends up back at Largo's place. And this is where we get the big sort of, you know, Enter the Dragon type sequence with him sneaking around, and then the guards catch him, and then they go after him, and then he ends up in the swimming pool, basically. And this is where we get the scene I talked about earlier with the plexiglass that was a little bit short, and Sean Connery has his encounter with the sharks, and he manages to make it out of there, which is great. One thing I was slightly worried about was animal welfare on this film. Because there were some shots of some dead sharks. And I think at one point they
No, they weren't dead. They're alive. They'd been drugged, apparently, because at one point they revived in the water and it got a bit scary. They drugged them and then dragged them along with wire. That's
right, yeah.
One kind of shook or woke itself up whilst filming, apparently.
Because again, Bob Simmons talked about...
Was this the sort of film where at the end credits, because I didn't sit through the entire end credits, but is this one of those films where they said no animals were harmed at the end of this film? That kind of thing.
Sorry, we're just talking about animals being harmed and animal welfare, and my Bengals basically just appeared flicking a tail in front of me, but the guys can only see the tail, so it looks like it's some weird sort of dildo or something that's waving in front of the camera.
Microphone noises as well for you.
Yeah, exactly, because she's just completely whiplashed my condenser mic. Thank you for that. Yeah, no, but there was, you're right, John, because there was one incident Bob Simmons, he again talked about in an interview where he basically had this drugged shark and he was meant to sort of bring it into the middle of the pool. And as he was bringing it, he kind of was really nervous. And then all of a sudden, the shark resuscitated itself sooner than it should have done or gained consciousness. And then there was a shark out of its corner of its eye, and that the drugged shark went for the other shark, took a chunk out of it, and there was blood in the water, and then all of a sudden it was just a frenzy, and Bob Simmons, the stuntman, was right in the middle of it. He couldn't get out of the pool in time, so there's all these sharks going on around him, like attacking each other, and he said the swimming pool was like just completely filled with blood. It was crazy. It was basically Alex's pool carnage thing.
It's what happened, he was talking about earlier. Exactly.
Yeah. But thankfully, Bob made it out alive. So then Bond gets to do it with Fiona, which I think is the first time, maybe the only time, that he actually beds someone in this film. Is it the third?
He's done it before.
Yeah, because he does Spar Girl, doesn't he? Because he blackmails her into it.
Doesn't he? I think Domino's at the end of the film, isn't it? Behind a rock.
Yeah, Domino's at the end. Yeah, yeah. In fact, she was meant to be twice. Because they allude to it, but they're not actually allowed to show it. So when they meet and he saves her, then there's bubbles, and they go off shot, and there's meant to be bubbles. And there was meant to be, meant to lose her underwear at that point, but they said, no, that's too much.
I can't see Kelly Brockman liking that very much, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at least sort of have a conversation before we try and bang someone.
God dear.
So on the shagometer, that's number three then.
Yeah,
well, I think that's number two, and number three's later on.
Yeah, three's later. Okay. That's right.
Right, so this is number two. Yeah. I mean, we're more than halfway through the film now. So anyway, and then she gets killed shortly after, because again they go after him. So this is like attempt on Bond's life number eight or nine, I think. Spectre are completely useless by this point. And basically, as they're having a little dance, someone's...
This is at
pulls
the after the junkery.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Is it some henchman aiming for Bond from like a distance?
Yeah, they're aiming for him, and then there's a quick... He's a quick move,
yeah.
And then she gets killed. And then he literally says, you know, I think she's going to sit this one out. She's dead.
She's dead tired. Yeah.
This was
that's it.
And this was at the Kiss Kiss Club in the.
That's right.
Which is because the actual soundtrack was supposed to be Tom Jones was supposed to sing Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, so maybe that had something to do with the name of the club.
Oh.
Yeah, maybe.
Was he meant to be singing in the club live at the while filming?
No, the soundtrack was supposed instead of Thunderball. The name of the song was supposed to be Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yeah.
And they named the club Kiss Club.
So Bond and Felix go up in a helicopter, and they manage to find the wreckage of the plane that had the nukes.
Yeah.
The Vulcan plane, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And then shortly after this is where Domino and Bond are on the beach together. And Bond has, you know, had a swim down, had a little look, found the dead pilots, taken Domino's brother's tags and stuff, and his watch. And then he's with Domino on the beach, and this is where he turns her, basically, because not in the same way that he turned pussy galore, but he breaks the news to her that her brother's dead and that Largo's not who she thought he was. Yeah. Surprise, surprise, right, John?
No, I'm sorry. I'm surprised at the cat leaping onto the cupboard above your head, mate, behind you. Sorry.
Oh. Oh, sorry, Jesse, up there. Yeah, sorry. Okay, great. Now the Bengals. So we haven't had any dogs on the podcast today. That's refreshing. But with Largo, so what was the deal between Largo and Domino? Was she his kind of niece-y type companion, or was she actually in bed with him?
I think it's like sort of a trophy wife, but without the complicated extra bits. I think she just accompanies him to, like, you know, events and things and looks nice, I guess. Who knows?
Like an escort?
Well, yeah, I guess. But with, you know, with the benefits of the high life and, you know, nice, somewhat nice. All her clothes are black and white, hence the name Domino. So she's dressing in all the nice black and white clothes that she wears and things like that. So, you know.
Yeah.
It's never really made clear, is it?
Yeah, but we do get a really, I mean, this is one of the Sean Connery quips that I always remember, you know, when what's his face, the weird looking spectre henchman, basically is behind a tree and then she's like, oh, he's over there. And so Bond just grabs the spear gun. It's like, I think he got the point.
Yeah, very good.
That I do remember from when I was a child, actually. I really love those little moments when I think Connery, he does that really, really well. And some of his natural sense of humour, his what he must have been like in real life, really comes out there as well. It's very, as corny as those lines are, there's an honesty about them in a way. It's hard for me to describe, but I laugh at them, but not in the way that I laugh when Arnold Schwarzenegger does them. Although I love Arnie.
Roger Moore's the best deliverer of quips, though, of all the Bonds.
Do you know what, John? I can't wait now to get to Live and Let Die and do the Roger Moore ones. I'm so excited now. I really am. I kind of wasn't bothered before, but now as we're going through this, I can't wait to get to them. So it'll be all I can do to stop myself from jumping ahead. But yeah, I can't wait to get to those now. So this really swings the kind of final third act of the film into motion, because obviously now Domino knows that Largo is evil and is responsible for her brother's death. So now Bond has to run around in a different type of toupee that kind of manages to stay on his head when it's got lots of water on it, and just a tiny pair of shorts, and try and infiltrate the dive team of Spectre. Because they're obviously going to take the nukes out and they're going to move them somewhere. And this is when the CIA turn up, just as Bond is found out by the Spectre guys underwater. And then this basically
comes in, Bobby. It's not the CIA, it's the US Navy.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think so.
It's CIA, US Navy, yeah. FBI, you know, NYPD, LAPD. Well, I think it's all the same, isn't it?
Jurisdiction, isn't it, really, of the area?
Chicago Fire. Orange is the New Black. No, that's not the medical one. What's it? Grey's Anatomy. All the same. But they. But this again. I appreciate that it was obviously important to the film, and it was, you know, pretty much the whole end set piece. But again, it just went on for such a long time for me. They spent over $85,000 on diving equipment for this sequence, for that battle between the U.S. Navy and Spectre. And they used 60 divers. And when they got their heads together to try and work out how they were going to do the sequence, because also, and give them credit, nobody had ever really done this on film. No one had ever done this on film before. It was like the underwater mayhem. It was like the underwater version of the mayhem in that Gypsy Village scene in From Russia With Love. It was absolutely bonkers. And that was basically the thing that they said that they, when they discussed it, they basically said, let's just think of every type of underwater mayhem imaginable and just do all of that. And do all of that they did. But I did find it a bit repetitive. I think that they could have just, again, it could have just been edited a bit more concisely for me. How did you guys find that whole underwater sequence? Phil?
I was going to say that I personally felt that I, for the first time in all of the films that we've seen leading up to this point, I felt a real sense of danger for the characters in that they were having hand-to-hand combat. They weren't shooting guns from a distance. They were underwater. There was a real chance that they could have either drowned or got stabbed. And they had to do it underwater. And it looked like the people that were trained to do it, the US Navy, were far less equipped than those henchmen that were provided by Spectre, which didn't seem right. It should be that the people that are enforcing should have the better weapons. But then all of a sudden, you've got James Bond, who's a complete outsider, has the motorized, and this is what I'm talking about in terms of the real gadgets, he has the motorized power thing going underwater with that the yellow...
Yeah.
And then he was able to take out several of the henchmen, you know, in a single blow.
Well, don't forget he's Commander Bond, which is a naval rank, isn't it, Commander Bond?
Right.
I think his background is in the Navy, actually, before he became a Secret Service agent. So he may have had some deep-sea training.
Yeah. But I felt, although to you guys it felt like it went on for a long time, I saw it for the first time, putting my head on, you know, 1965 head. It, to me, looked dangerous. It looked scary as a viewer. And I felt a real sense of danger for the characters.
Yeah. Alex?
I enjoyed it. I think it's just, it was, some parts of it were slow. And I think it was clever what they did with some of the sequences, you know, with the bubbles and, you know, oh, they found me. Oh, no, I've just nipped out. And now I'm using my rebreather and I'm all nippy and everything. So I thought all of that was clever, but it was just, there's a lot of it. And I do agree with Phil, because it's, you get an understanding of the scale of the battle that you don't normally get in a Bond. So normally, even if things are happening behind the scenes, you're just focusing on Bond and what he's doing. You're not focusing on anything else. Whereas you did feel like it was a battle rather than just like a little scene. So I did like that. But it was kind of, you know, what's going to happen. It was one of those things where you knew that something would have to be resolved. You couldn't just have them win. And then that's when they go to the boats. But yeah, no, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. We then move from there because basically I was going to get you to comment on the next bit.
Well, I mean, I
but go on, have
my say. Yeah, I mean, I'm with Phil. I appreciate the technical mastery of the filming, and it was something really new for the audience at the time. And I enjoyed it for a bit, but then I went and made a cup of tea and came back and they were still fighting. It reminded me a bit of the, in terms of the scope and the ambition for its time, of the battle scene in Moonraker with all the space people floating around. And like, you know, obviously that was done with special effects and back screens and things, but I'm sure at the time it was quite an interesting watch, but I found it a little bit, it dragged a bit, but I can appreciate its mastery.
You know, when you get in the water for too long and you get all wrinkly, I just feel like they got to the wrinkly point. Well, I just thought, you know, it's not attractive when you get wrinkly, you need to come out. I think that's true of a film just as much as it is when you're in the bath or whatever. Sorry. Did I ruin it?
Ever practical?
No, not at all, but you're right. Do you know what? Any budding film directors, future Steven Spielbergs or whatever, that are listening to this, right? Listen to what Alex said. So if you've got a script in front of you that you've got to work out to film and it's got underwater sequences in it, use the before you get wrinkly rule. That's your time limit.
Exactly.
I think Alex can create a new role for the film industry. Rather than being a continuity guy, we need the pedantic fine detail guy on set. It's time to get out now.
Come on,
back in 5 minutes. You've eaten, you know.
Yeah,
tummy ache,
that,
all that sort of
that
stuff.
That towel's completely impractical, right? Here you are. Let me give you a big one. Right, there you go.
Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond. I expect you to get out of the water now.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
So Bond exits this scene eventually, after killing a good few people and helping the US Army to turn the tide against Spectre. So he leaves them to kind of mop up and arrest everyone or whatever it is they're doing underwater. And he then gets back to the Disco Volante, the yacht, to confront Largo. And I presume rescue Domino, because obviously she's had her fair share of trouble on there because he's been trying to torture her with a lit cigar and ice cubes. Freaking weirdo. And they have a fight. And the yacht's going really, really fast. And I know that it's a screen behind the windows and that the yacht was recreated on set in Pinewood Studios. But there are long moments where they should really have crashed quite a few times and blown up in that scene.
It was just like they careened towards the thing and then they changed the shot and then they were still careening towards it and you're thinking, hang on a minute, which bit have you hit?
But you see, this is the thing, right? So here they used a new editing style that hadn't really been used in film before. So this was very quick edits and so on to create, you know, the thrill of the fight and, you know, amp up the impact of the violence and so on. But, you know, Domino shoots Largo in the end and kills him and she gets her revenge. And then she kind of stands there for a moment and her and Bond have this kind of exchange between each other. And while it's all, I don't know what they said, because I was just looking out the window thinking, rocks, you're going to crash. So they had this guy, I'll look his name up, I wrote it down somewhere, but he was the production team's Mr. Fix-It, this American dude, Charlie Rusom. And there's a little Easter egg in Goldfinger, there's a little Easter egg in the town where, you know, near where Fort Knox is, the Rusom Supply Company or something like that. But Charlie Rusom was there, Mr. Fix-It. He's the guy that got them into Fort Knox for Goldfinger. And for this film, he managed to procure experimental rocket fuel, gave it to the SFX and stunt guys. Basically said, try this for blowing up the Volante at the end. So they rigged it and they blew the thing up and they weren't prepared for the explosion. It was apparently the biggest explosion in film history to that point. It blew the ship clean out of the water where they saw some debris, but the ship had disappeared and basically had blown it all the way up in the air and then it was coming back on down on top of them. And apparently the explosion from this experimental rocket fuel was so big, 30 miles away in Nassau, they'd blown the windows out of the main street. So, I imagine that contributed.
Thunderball. I mean, what were we expecting? Yeah.
Sorry, are you saying I'm complaining?
That explains why the explosion was so big. Because it's like normally you get the model and then you see the model explode and you're just thinking, well, hang on a minute, that's way too much. But this was an actual boat.
Yeah.
That they exploded.
With actual experimental rocket fuel that Charlie Chazza Rusom had got from somewhere, we don't know where, to this day, and just given it to them and said, here, this will catch fire. Give it a go. So that was pretty much the end of the film. We get the obligatory end scene where Domino and Bond basically are in a little rubber dinghy waiting to be rescued. But then he hooks that. I wasn't expecting this. It was pretty cool. He sort of sets it up and then hooks this thing onto the back of the collar of his dive suit, and then she sort of grabs onto him and then he holds her and then all of a sudden they're sky hooked out of the dinghy onto a plane and away they go. John.
Now, gamer fans amongst you will recognise this from Metal Gear Solid. It's called the Fulton system. It's actually developed by American military. It's just a way of getting certain things out of the military zone very quickly, but it's used a lot in Metal Gear Solid. Whenever you take a guy down and you knock him out, you can attach a balloon to his back and a plane will come past and pick him up. or helicopter, and you can actually turn him to your team, and you can actually he becomes one of your operatives. So I saw that straight away and thought Metal Gear Solid straight away. Fulton System. It's pretty cool. It's a bit of an abrupt ending, though, don't you think, for the film?
Yeah. Roger Moore wouldn't have done that. Roger Moore would have got rid of the Skyhook altogether.
he'd have just floated away, having a bit of nookie and making some funny quips about I don't know, you know.
Re-entry.
Yeah. Spot on, Bobby. Very good.
Just one thing. Is this the first film where the actual Bond girl kills the enemy and the Bond girl gets revenge rather than James Bond killing the enemy?
I think you might be right.
I guess so.
Bill, yeah. Is there another film like this where the Bond girl...
It happens again. I'm sure it happens in some of the more recent ones. But,
but she actually is the one that gets her revenge. So they actually do think about, you know, her desire for revenge, and they do give her the option to make the kill, which I thought was quite a nice touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like the fact that Domino, I mean, I know they had the underwater thing with the bubbles and it was all very suggestive and so on, but I like the fact that she wasn't just an obvious bit of eye candy that he was going to bed and then she was going to be fawning all over him and so on. There was a good bit of interplay between them, and I think she was a really well-written character. Domino works really, really well for me.
I've just quickly tried to find out whether any other Bond girls kill off the villains, and it's quite depressing when you Google it. It just comes up with top 10 lists of every woman who's died from sleeping with James Bond, and they're quite comprehensive lists.
Maybe it's not good reading.
It's not. Yeah. No, it's not. Don't look it up. So,
I think John, you'll find it's a similar list to. Harrison Ford co-stars that have worked after they've worked with Harrison Ford.
Oh, I tell you what, there's an amazing database we've built here, isn't there, Phil?
Yeah, it's true.
Blimey. So the film opened on December the 21st, 1965. It absolutely smashed all box office records. I'm sure Alex is already looking it up and might have the numbers to hand, but on a $9 million budget, it was over $150 million was the take.
Yeah, that's what IMDb says, but I think it took more by the end of it.
It was a pretty healthy return. So, you know, they had this big money-spinning juggernaut and don't think the producers were ever intending to stop. And thank heavens they didn't. So, reviews. It's really funny with this film, guys, because... this film's very, very Marmite. It's got an odd place in Bond history in terms of the attitude towards it from the fans, because people either love it and hail it as one of the greatest Bond films ever, and other people don't like it. They say it's lazy. By now, they've obviously got their formula, but Connery looks sort of a bit haggard and doesn't look like he's interested in playing Bond anymore. He's fed up with it. So it's kind of it's a difficult one, but we're going to come on to our ratings, and if we can think back to what we've rated the previous three films, so we rated them quite highly. No, actually, I did. You guys, there were some sixes in there. But let's go to Phil first of all. So Phil, what did you think of Thunderball overall, and what would your rating be?
I thought the film was very understated. It didn't go in your face as much as some of the other films did. Where they, in previous films, introduced the car and they introduced things like the suits and things like that. There was, I think, some of the best suits in all the films so far. I mean, I made a note of one. He had a beautiful grey suit during the Jacaboo Festival.
Junkaroo
Festival. Really beautiful grey suit that was in that scene. There was, the great gadgets. You know, M was on location, so he didn't have a massive amount of gadgets. So everything was very understated. It looks like they spent a lot of the budget on the... That's the one. It looks like they spent a lot of the budget on the underwater stuff, so they had to kind of focus on the on the story more, but the locations, it looked really beautiful. So I actually really enjoyed this film. I would actually give this an 8.5.
Wow.
I could watch this again and again and again, and I'd get something new from it every single time, I think.
Yeah. Wow. Alex?
It's funny, because I've rated some of the others quite highly, and for this one, I don't know why, but it just didn't chime with me. I think because it was meant to be like bolder and bigger than the others, I think that kind of the story wasn't a big part of this, really. There was a story, but it just didn't feel like it led the film as much. I just didn't seem to relate to it as much as like I did with some of the previous ones.
Country spanning international spies do you relate to exactly, Alex?
Jason Bourne.
Bourne's a better spy. I don't know what it was about the film. I think probably there was lots of swimming sequences. And I can't swim, so that's maybe that was it. But I don't know what it was, but it had all the pieces of a really good film, and that's why it did so well, because of that. But for me, I didn't get it, and I think there was nothing wrong with it per se, but I just wanted a slightly more subtler sort of film. Like we'll have more examples coming up. So, so for me, I mean, I think it's very competent. So I would give it a 7, but I don't think I would give it an 8 or 9. I think also the kind of some of his acquisition of women was quite rapey. And I think that did put me off. Although it's just a character and it's not to be taken seriously. I think some of those happening quite so early as they did, I was just like, okay, that's, I knew this was coming, but it just, yeah, it put me off a bit.
Yeah. John?
Well, I do agree with a lot of what Axis says, but I think we need to remember, we can't discount how important this film is for launching a franchise. True. And setting the standard in terms of, you know, the characters and the gadgets, Q&M and so on. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, without this film, we wouldn't have had the massive franchise we have now. So I've got to give them a point for that, but I might take half a point off for just so much attention to bedding women in one film. I think he's being a bit selfish and perhaps pace himself a bit more, at least. But it's a tricky one. There's a whole podcast about this, about how we feel about this. We've got to appreciate the film as it is, as a historical record, and times were different, but we don't want to encourage more films like this now. So I'm going to take a half point off for Bond's, you know, kind of slapdash approach to chatting ladies up. Take a bit more time, take them out. Don't just force yourself on them in a sauna. You know, it's not great. So I'll probably take a half a point off for that. But it is I did enjoy the film, and I liked just the variety of locations and set pieces, the style, the glamour. I do really enjoy the style of the 60s in itself. I think it's a really, I can see it coming back. That kind of, not the hippie style, but the really haute couture, lovely, you know, style that influences designers like Tom Ford and so on. I know you're not a big fan of Tom Ford, Bobby, but, you know, Dior Man and things like that.
No, I'm absolutely a fan of Tom Ford. What I'm not a fan of is the actual tailoring, especially when you look at whoever was responsible for costume in Skyfall and whatever was off Spectre. It just wasn't as clean as it could have been. And I know that I would have done a better job. Anyway, there we go. So what was your rating?
So I was going to give it, I think, probably a 7.5 out of 10.
Okay. So for me, I'm oscillating between 5, but I think that's quite harsh given, because there was a lot of effort that went into this production. But it's definitely not a 7.
Give it an extra point for explosion, Bobby, at least.
No. Okay. No. I refuse. No. Dr. No. I think a 6 seems fair from me. And I agree with some of what Alex said, and I think it definitely has got the formula of Bond as we know it, and they did go bigger and better, and there were some moments where it did feel like you were sort of, you know, back in the saddle with the family again, but at the same time, I just think a lot of the scenes, there was no point the director lingering on, you know, coral reefs and fish swimming through them for 20 seconds, 30 seconds at a time. It was absolutely pointless, other than to show what a beautiful location they were in. And, you know, the underwater scene we've already talked about, the big one at the end, just dragged on a little bit too much for me. I'm not a big fan of scuba diving and stuff because I can't swim very well, so that could well be informing my rating here. It's too much time in the water, as Alex said. And now that Alex has come up with the wrinkle theory, I totally agree. Yeah, that just takes the realism out of it for me. You'd never be underwater for that length of time and not come out looking like...
However, the body's response to water immersion over time, the wrinkle, is not anything to do with the actual water. It's actually to make your fingers more grippy. That's what the wrinkling effect is for. So you can like, and if their fingers are more grippy, then they can hold onto the guns more effectively. So maybe they wouldn't get out. Maybe the wrinkle effect is so they can hold onto their spear guns even more effectively.
Yeah, but then if you're in there an excessively long time, it goes from wrinkly to starting to deteriorate. Your skin looks like you haven't moisturized for years and years
Now, just Phil has wandered off camera here. Now, I think he's got something important to show us.
Ah, okay.
He's going to the hot tub to test out this theory.
I can't decide which.
Or he's gone to feed his sharks in his tank outside his... Yeah.
I've got to go and get my lights sorted on my hot tub. So now that we've talked about underwater lights, I've got to get my lights on.
Phone Keith.
Yeah, I'll look it up.
So the next Bond film is...
On Her Majesty's Secret Service, isn't it?
No.
Is that right?
It's You Only Live Twice.
Oh, is it?
In fact, the next Bond film is actually Casino Royale. The Peter Sellers, David Niven version. That came out in 1967.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought that came out sooner.
So... I don't know if we want to just watch that one for its and giggles.
I think we should. Yeah, You Only Live Twice. Yeah.
That's it. Speaking of You Only Live Twice, Phil's just completely dropped off. I was trying to link that really cleverly there with a Bond title and I couldn't think of one. But yeah, Phil's completely dropped off. You Only Leave Twice. Yes, exactly. So yeah, 1967, Casino Royale is the next Bond, in inverted commas, film to be released. I might actually go revisit that one just for a laugh. they rerun it on TV sometimes.
Is it part of the Bond canon still, though? Because it's not in the list.
But funny enough, it is
in the James Bond archives, which is every film from Dr. No through to... No Time to Die.
Right.
So it's sat here. I'm looking at the opening introduction page. Okay. So he's an older Bond and he's pulled out of retirement to investigate the death of M at M's ancestral home in Scotland. There's a bit of kind of canon linking there because, oh no, that was Bond's ancestral home in Scotland in Skyfall. Yeah. Phil, you're back.
Hey there.
Yeah. Was there, John said that you'd gone to get something that he felt would be of importance to this episode. So what have you got to show us?
The other thought, it might be you've gone for a wee, Phil. We couldn't decide which. So,
it was the latter.
Ah, okay.
Did you go and wee on your own leg?
It doesn't work on your own.
Have you been shot? Can everyone just stop getting shot?
Oh, very good.
I think, thank you guys. Thank you so much. I think that wraps it up for this one. Phil, we were just saying that the next film actually is Casino Royale, 1967.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
If you're up for that one.
Oh, yes.
But it's not canon. But maybe we just
make
it
an extra.
Do it as a bonus Bondathon?
Yeah.
Yeah? All right. So that'll be our kind of little, whatchamacallit? When they give you those little things to refresh the palate cleanser,
yes,
before we continue. Yeah?
Or an entree.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, an entree.
Make it a little entree. Guys, thank you so much. Phil, have you had a good time? You always have a good time.
It's been fantastic. Thanks very much for making me a part of this podcast. I would like the fact that we had differing opinions on this one as well. And, you know, and I want to kind of see it again to kind of like make sure that, you know, my first instinct was the correct one.
Yeah, I've got no desire to see it again, to be quite honest. John, thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you on Friday evening. Oh, and we're going to do a little live reaction recording for Doctor Strange, aren't we, afterwards? So I'll plug play pause turn in just a second. Alex, thank you so much.
That's all right.
Our love to Amy. We miss her, but hopefully we'll see her over on PPT at some point soon.
Yeah, don't forget the wrinkly fingers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we've just established a new. I'm gonna send that to RADA and, you know, the New York School of Movie Making. So if you've enjoyed today's episode, you might enjoy another little podcast that Alex, John and I are slightly involved with called Play Paul's Turn. It's available on wherever you like to get your podcasts. But John, Alex, myself, Alex's lovely wife Amy and our dear friend Mark get together every so often to talk about the things that we've been watching, playing or reading. So that's Play Paul's Turn. You can also find Play Paul's Turn on Twitter and just search for it. You'll find it and subscribe and give it lots of love. To all of you listening, thank you so much for joining us. It's been just the most wonderful time discussing this movie, even if, for me at least, it didn't live up to the high bar set by the previous three. Anyway, we do have You Only Live Twice to look forward to next month, and we'll try and fit the Peter Sellers Casino Royale in between. Make sure you hit that subscribe button so you don't miss a thing. And of course, if you'd like to join us on future Bondathon episodes, please do get in touch via the Instagram page at Tailoring Talk Podcast, or email the show directly at tailoringtalkpodcast@gmail.com. We already have Richard Gore lined up for On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and Kevin Foster is lined up for probably a few, if not all, of the Roger Moore movies. Regular Tailoring Talk collaborator Artif Ghaffar has volunteered for Moonraker because nobody else seems to want to. I think John will be up for that one, though, because his favourite Bond villain's in it. And they'll nearly always be joined by the fabulous Play Paul's Turn podcast crew and, of course, Philip Rahman. That's it for this episode. James Bond, and we will return. We hope you do too. I'm not sure if that was grammatically correct, but I hope you have a great week, whatever you're up to. And we'll see you on the next one. I know, John. I'm John's washing up buddy. In fact, whenever I'm recording without you lot, I'm always thinking about John doing the washing up in his marigolds.
Thrusting deep into the bubbly water, lingering, lingering on the dishes, the squeak of cleanliness emerging.
I really hope you've started recording. The outtakes are going to be priceless.